We're now in a different administration, the Trump administration, and Donald Trump himself, and the uncertainty that lies ahead in terms of possible war with North Korea, and of course the ongoing wars that we're waging in other parts of the world. Is there a heightened concern maybe that you have under Trump that you didn't have maybe other presidents, or is this just business as usual here in the US?
Well, I think that there's no mask on President Trump. To some extent, I think President Obama, President Clinton, even at times President Bush, were able to put at least a mask of stability on policies that were murderous and treacherous and cruel. I mean, I was at the bedsides of Iraqi children who were literally starving and thirsting to death, and those economic sanctions continued to punish children. I lived in Baghdad all through the shock and awe bombing, and it was hideous. It was shocking. It was awful. But what's you could find at times a little bit more predictability in other presidencies, but I think that President Trump is erratic. He's undereducated, and he's a very, very dangerous person. And he surrounds himself by people who, it seems, increasingly tell him what he wants to hear. But he also has certainly elevated the status of generals within his administration. So it's a frightening time. There are some who just seem hell-bent toward going after Iran, and among them are some of Trump's closest advisors, General Mattis and Mr. Bolton. And, it seems as though the United States is saying to the Saudi crown prince, okay, you've got another year, see if you can win this war, and we'll equip him with all kinds of weaponry and kind of a look the other way, even just as more civilians were killed in a vicious bombing that happened in the port of Hodeidah in Yemen because of the Saudi-led coalition's ability to wage aerial war against civilians. So we certainly see under President Trump a pressure to continue defense spending and reliance on wars. And we saw that in a recent vote when it looked possible for senators to intervene and say, look, at least we should invoke the War Powers Act and have a discussion about whether or not the United States is at war with Yemen. And if we're not, then why are we sending weapons to the Saudis and assisting the Saudis with military maneuvers that kill civilians? But President Trump and his generals did not want that discussion to happen, and they put a great deal of pressure on senators not to vote for it.
Now, Kathy, you have been trying to go to Yemen to see what's going on. Tell us what's happened.
I have tried to go to Yemen. Maria Benjamin and I have petitioned for permission to be on the one flight that goes into Yemen since April of last year, and we've had no success. The Saudis vet every passenger on that one plane. It's a plane that's organized by the United Nations, the World Food Program, and the plane is vital. It's needed. I mean, only one flight goes in for a country of 22 million people. It's bringing humanitarian relief and crucial aid workers, but quite often in the past, before the Saudis became involved in Yemen's civil war, journalists could hop onto that plane, or sometimes human rights activists. But the Saudis assure the United Nations that if they take anybody on that plane who's not a bona fide UN worker or somebody who has a registered job that's been with a group that's been in place for a long time inside of Yemen, the Saudis, when that plane lands, will deny fuel so that the plane can't return. So everybody's had to sort of cooperate with the Saudi insistence that BBC, 60 Minutes, you name it, nobody is getting on that plane. Now, why is there only one plane going into Yemen? Because the Saudis are insisting on a blockade, even though their PR groups try to say, oh, well, the blockade is lifted. The blockade on the major port of Hodeidah, wherein 80% of Yemen's goods would traditionally flow, is still very, very much in place.
Given the Saudis' control of who's even getting into Yemen. And given what's happening in Yemen itself and the bombardment, the bombing of the country with from the Saudis, remind our listeners, why are the Saudis so involved in Yemen? What is the geopolitical relationship between the two? And then, of course, America's complicity in that by supporting the Saudi regime and selling them the weapons.
Well, it seems as though the Saudi crown prince thought that he could go into Yemen very quickly, have a big win, and basically do a land grab, almost like Manifest Destiny, perhaps. And Yemen does have some potential mineral resources. And, of course, that coastline is very, very important for shipping and travel purposes. Unfortunately, the Saudi prince has also said, even though he may have thought it would be a quick war, he has also gone on national TV and said to the Saudi people, time is on our side. A prolonged war is in our favor. And I suppose what that means to him is that he can tighten the thumbscrews. He can make life even more unlivable for people in Yemen. And eventually, anybody opposing the Saudi will or the will of the Saudi-led coalition will submit and say, "Okay, we give up. We can't survive this." But the Houthi fighters, who are in control of the port of Hodeidah, of that city, have not relinquished their control, and the Saudis haven't been able to dislodge them. And so as the war goes on, the statistics just get worse and worse. The UN people say, you know, it's like an apocalypse. You've got a country where in every 10 minutes, a child under five dies from starvation or a preventable disease. Every 2 minutes, a child succumbs to severe malnutrition. People aren't getting food. They're not getting water. And then to compound the misery, just across the Red Sea, the waterway is called the Bab al-Mandab, the Gate of Tears. In Africa, there is a third year, in fact, now going on a fourth year of drought, so that the numbers of people that could die because of famine there are in the vicinity of 20 million people. And the UN is saying that 8 million people are on the verge of conflict-driven famine in Yemen. So it's a hideous situation. It's the worst possible situation into which more weapons could be sent, because when there's that much chaos, it gets exploited by human traffickers and by weapon smugglers. And meanwhile, the United States is supporting the Saudi-led coalition in consistent bombing. I mean, General Mattis has said, yeah, that's true. We are supporting them. We are involved in the war. And you know what? If we weren't, it'd be worse, because if the Saudis weren't given military mid-air refueling from the United States, then they'd have to do their bombing sorties more quickly, and they'd be nervous, and they'd target places with even less precision. Well, that's a crazed argument, that we have to fuel Saudis' planes when they come back from one bombing sortie so that they can refuel and go back out and bomb again, because we want to give them more time to be precise. And they've been hitting civilians constantly, and the United States does the same thing. In October of 2015, October 2nd, the United States hit a hospital in Kunduz, in Afghanistan. That same month, October 27th, the Saudis hit the U.S. hit a Doctors Without Borders hospital. Later that same month, the Saudis hit a Doctors Without Borders hospital. And in both cases, the bombing went on for over an hour. And, and the generals can then turn around and say, oh, we're getting advice about how to be more precise in our targeting. I think the U.S. public ought not to be distracted from these patterns, but instead what they see is, the Saudi prince being received by Oprah Winfrey, the Saudi prince is being met by President Obama, the Saudi prince is going to MIT and meeting dignitaries. Well, we live in a country that fought a revolution in our history, believing there's no such thing as royal blood. And yet, we're asked to treat this person who has orchestrated a butchery in one of the poorest countries in the world as though he's somehow to be revered for his royalty.
How do we change all of this? How can people resist this dominant narrative that has become ever more dominant, regardless of who's in the White House, about being exceptional here in the US, about this militaristic attitude and the endless war that we're in? How can people resist that?
Well, I think we can take a cue from the young people who walked out of their high schools massively, caught courage from one another, and have shook up the National Rifle Association somewhat. And who knows what will come further from that. I think we can take a cue from the people who said, hey, we know we're lined up against snipers and tanks, but we're going to go assert our right to reclaim our land. And I think that's what happened in Gaza, and 17 people so far have been killed. But I think there's a great deal of bravery there. So, I'm kind of amazed that in Afghanistan, in the province of Helmand, there are people who are very, very vulnerable to being killed by both sides of terrible conflict going on. And they're setting up tents and saying, we're going to vigil and we're going to try to form a walk, and we're sick and tired of war. We want negotiations. We want peace. So, I mean, we have a much louder voice than any Yemeni child who's too hungry to cry. So we should be going to our congresspeople's offices, to our senators' offices, go again and again, form a different delegation with four new people, but keep on insisting that we don't want these wars. And then, of course, educate our communities, as people are doing in Denver and in Colorado Springs. I think that it's, in a sense, I look at what's required of people who are bearing the brunt of our wars, and it's almost like it's the least we can do. And we don't know when a tipping point could happen. Revolutions do take place. There was a time when nobody could imagine that you couldn't smoke in classrooms and on airplanes and in restaurants, and now you wouldn't dare. I think we should keep our hope alive that a significant change will happen, and the reckless people who are in charge of the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, will eventually find that they're not able to keep the reins of power any longer.
Well, there is a midterm election coming up in 2018. Do you hear any of the candidates, particularly ones that are really challenging the dominance of both of the main political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats? Are you hearing an anti-war narrative being put forward by anyone?
Well, I guess that would be a stretch to say, are we hearing an anti-war narrative? I mean, I think Bernie Sanders did speak up, but he has never said that he would take on the military-industrial complex, or even say within his own state that he doesn't want the military corporations functioning. But I was impressed that given the vote regarding Yemen, as many as 44 senators did say to the Trump administration, basically, you know what, you haven't persuaded us. There were 55 senators that said that they didn't want the discussion about the War Powers Act to be invoked with regard to Yemen. But 44 was a sign that there's some movement. So, the major corporations can pay think tanks and public relations companies, and we're outspent and outmaneuvered in the peace movement, in the anti-war movement. But given that disparity, I think you do see grassroots movements persisting and continuing, and with far more ethical grounding than any of these big, huge weapon companies have.